is in, you can say, fine version of Pro, and one version of Pro is the default version that you get introduced by Pro. You don't want to change that, because suddenly it might depend on very specific behavior of that particular Pro release or that particular application version, where changing it could break too many things. Okay? And the general intent is that the application developer chooses the dependency that the application has, and I'll show an example next. So, suppose I have a trading application that uses just only two dependencies. In practice, it's like 40, but only two dependencies, Sybase and libxml. So, the application is stored somewhere under a prefix, and then team name, application name, a release number, exec, bin, application. And it has dependencies where it goes to the Sybase open client, say release 12.5.1, slash lib, again, there's a hidden exec somewhere. And then libct, lib client library. And for libxml, it goes prefix, fsf for Free Software Foundation, libxml, again a particular release number, libxml itself. So application owners are forced to specify extremely long and complex paths to specify exactly what release of what library they depend on. But the key to that is that we will never update those libraries or those dependencies in place. If a new Sybase release comes out, we'll put that side by side with the existing Sybase releases. If a new XML release comes out, we'll put it side by side with the new XML release, the old XML release. And then when an application owner next compiles the application, he or she can choose to upgrade the application dependencies. We don't do that for him or her. So as a result, our Android file system contains, it's like a trash can, it contains every release of every application that anyone ever thought that he or she needed. And it's very, very hard to ever get rid of anything, because you might unintentionally break something. Example is that we tried to decode, say, an IBM MP Series client that was end of life by IBM in 1997. But we still have like two or three applications that depend on it, and that make money for sure. So we can't just yank that to save 100 meg of disk space. Because, you know, there's millions of dollars that can actually be lost by having your exchange links done. So, from an infrastructure viewpoint, I see some of my infrastructure colleagues in the crowd. From an infrastructure viewpoint, one of the things you do is you track down people who use these antiquated libraries and try and get them to upgrade their application. But it has to be a voluntary thing. You can't force people to do that.
Do you log access?
Do we log access? Is a good question. The answer is no. The closest we can come to that with the Android file system is keep track of when a particular volume was last read and from which host. But you can't necessarily tell the application name or the user ID or the code.
How long can the client cache?
How long can the client cache that? I don't want to go too much into LFS details, but I think that our default is that a client can cache something for 24 hours and then call back to the server to ask for a particular volume, which contains up to, say, 2 gigabytes of data, has changed or not. And because AFS is stateful, if something changes in the file server will actually reach out to every client to tell the client to invalidate that portion of the client that the client's machines, the client host is cached. Do you have a question?
Do you have any auditing script that goes on, say, you know, I have this thing and it generates a list of everything that uses this thing that I want to grow out?
That's a good question. Do we have auditing scripts that try and keep track of these dependencies? And then the answer is like, we try to. But it doesn't always work. Some people write applications that they in turn invoke from the shell script that does all kinds of LD library path and LD preload tricks. So you can't necessarily predict how an application is really going to be run. So doing a decode or a change is always going to be somewhat risky.
Especially on Linux, right?
No comment. Now, another example is, say, GoScript. If you look at GoScript, there are like lots of releases installed side by side, and applications pick their release they want. We don't update it in place because that might change behavior. And here's the tricky part. We don't compile every GoScript release for every platform out there. So when we build a new platform, say we build Linux for the Itanium, we take the then current GoScript release and compile it. We don't go back in history and say, well, we have these 40 old ancient history releases of GoScript out there. Let's try and compile them, each and every one of them for this new platform. So when an application developer ports their application to a new platform, it usually means that they have to remove the releases of all their dependencies and reintegrate and retest their application. And if somebody depends or works around a GoScript code that is fixed in a new release, who has to remove that workaround or promote a new workaround for the new ghost fix. Okay? Now, so just to give an example of the in-house application, we have over 500 people who do nothing but develop in-house applications. And we have hundreds more people who develop and support infrastructure like vendor applications. We have hundreds or thousands of applications, and people have to develop new apps while supporting the old ones. And as you all know, supporting the old one really means like blaming everybody else if it breaks and never teach it again. It also means that we have to retain the underlying build infrastructure for many, many years. So supposedly a team is running an 8-year-old application they wrote through some sort of automated training, and they haven't really made any significant changes to it. But now they have to patch in support for a new location or a new city or a new desk or something. They want to be able to recompile that with the same compiler, the same support libraries, the same makeries, the same makefuls that they used 8 years ago. So in our build environment, we very much try and mimic the same behavior as we have for applications, that everything that anyone ever used is still out there. Question enough? So a counterexample to this is security link, say OpenSSL, which everybody uses for their SSL stack, on which bugs are found with far too frequent occurs. So this is a place where you absolutely do want in-place patches, which you do want applications to pick up new releases. But at the same time, you also might be able to block this for your system's infrastructure. At the same time, you also want to be able to say, well, if this patch code is wrong, I would be able to back it out. So we play a Unix game with symlinks, where we reinstall SIGs OpenSSL version 0.7. We install 0.7-1-2-3. We put in a symlink at 0.7 that we're just swinging from one patch release to another patch release, and then we tell the application, use this symlink. Okay? So if we get a new patch, we go 0.7-patch15. We swing the symlink. All applications start using this new thing at the next time the application starts. Okay? If it then is broken, which sometimes happens, we can just swing the symlink back. We don't have to try and extract the binaries, do a recompile, push it out again. Swing the symlink relatively fast. However, there's still applications, of course, that will refuse to follow the guidelines and directly link to a particular patch release, and then the system sort of breaks. You have a question? That's a fair question. Suppose the question is, how do you deal with older releases if a boot is found? Well, suppose that somebody finds a new boot in 0.7 that was really present in all releases in the past 5 years, and only a patch of the most recent release is rolled out. Well, sometimes we do it backwards. Sometimes we make an executive decision to decode older releases and to help with the application we handle. It sort of depends on how important those applications are and how vocal their defenders are. If the application is written by a managing director, it's not going to get decoded.
A lot of them write applications.
Some of the managing directors get promoted after writing applications. The advantage of this general setup is that it's very, very easy to add hundreds of new hosts. We had some time when we really did a scale-up where we added about 500 to 600 Linux hosts per 4 weeks. And we don't have sysadmins running out like crazy with both CD-ROMs and trying to update this. We basically add each of these hosts to our central database and then suddenly remotely power flex the box that 20 minutes later is running a standard server board. Host fails, hardware failure, we have put in a completely new host in a new location. We can recreate the old host with the same host name, the same IP address, with a different Ethernet MAC address elsewhere in the machine room. So it's very easy to add new applications and new releases without breaking what's already out there. And in theory, every application can run everywhere. So the nice part of this design is that there's a very, very low marginal management cost, in the sense that adding more of the same is cheap. Making big changes becomes very, very expensive. Okay, so some things that we have to do. Open source applications have to be customized to run side by side in parallel. So you have to override some of the hardwired hardnets. Closed source applications can be a pain. You have to integrate them. New operating system releases has to be integrated in this sort of complex manner. When you integrate both OS and new hardware, it gets very, very expensive to do. So I want to go on next 5 minutes or so is to give an example of integrating one particular vendor application. And the case here, I think, is something that I've done myself, the IBM DB2 client. Now, I'm going to find lots of flaws with this application. Please don't take it as a general criticism. It's a fine product that just sucks to integrate in an environment like Verilog. So, the DB2 client for IBM is obviously a vendor application. You pay, you get a binary on the CD-ROM. The CD-ROM contains an installation script, and either, depending on the platform, say, Solaris package, root of RPMs, or whatever the native way to clip together binary installs for your platforms. And IBM assumes that you want to run one release of the client per host. You disclose a fixed location, you get that client, and nothing else. But in place at work, you want to install multiple versions side by side in AFS and allow an application to run any one of those versions. Now, at this point, I ask the guys, why would we want to do that? Why would we want to run 5,000, or actually, well, 50 versions of the DB2 client side by side, and not pick the client that we want? Anyone? Still doesn't break, I don't get fired, and basically, epic new releases are never 100% compatible with the previous release, unless they accidentally ship the same binaries twice. So, we're going to find applications that work fine with, say, version 8.2.5 that break with a bug fix in 8.2.6. So, applications will tend to work with some releases, but not with all the releases. And we especially saw this in the past with the Type 2 JDBC drivers, which is half Java, half C, and various JVMs. So, assume 1.2.4.2 JVM will work with 3 out of 5 DB2 driver releases for this application, and 3 out of 5 releases for another application, and 2 out of 5 releases for yet another application, because there's no release that works with all of them. So each application is going to have to pick a specific release it wants to run with, and we can't just go out and say there, this is what you will work. And since we don't want to tie applications to specific hosts, we can't say, well, this host runs this release of the DB2 client, and this other host puts this other release of the DB2 client, because then my applications will be tied to a specific set of hosts, and what I want to do is be able to move my application anywhere. Okay? And by installing all these versions side by side, what we allow application to do is to pick the release they want, stick with it, and still run anywhere. Am I making sense? Sorry, why would you do that? Is he talking about MQ secrets? Can we take it offline? Because it's a painful memory for me. I used to run an MQ engineering. But you can do the same thing. So, IBM assumes when you install this binary package, it takes a particular directory to install this client in. It assumes one release per machine, and the main library that an application links to us, which is called libdb2 of SL, in turn refers to dozens of sub-libraries. And it does so by embedding an archive of the location that they expect you to install things in. So, if you take the entire IBM client and install it in a completely non-standard location, and you link to libdb2 of SL, then the moment you invoke it, it's going to use the hard-coded archive and go to the default location and take all the other libraries it depends on, which, of course, will then break. Now, also just assume from the viewpoint of this description that I generally prefer to avoid editing vendor files. I can obviously do so, but the amount of support you get from the vendor decreases rapidly if you start editing the binary. So we don't do that. So the way we store a client in the annual file system is that I basically extract each release on a sacrificial machine, take the resulting directory tree, dump it to AFS, fix up some of the relative symlinks or absolute failed symlinks, and then have applications link to each and every library that they need. So instead of linking to just libdb2 of SO, they link to each of the interior libraries as well. And because you link to each and every library that you need, you avoid the whole embedded archive issue. Or an alternative, you can make sure that the default location where DB2 looks for its libraries doesn't exist. Just there's nothing there. So in that case, it has to avoid the R path, and it will switch back to something like the LD library path or LD preload or whatever. So that works fine for in-house applications, where we can do the linking ourselves, and we can control the full set of libraries if you want to. But IBM-supplied binaries, or vendor-supplied binaries, you can't actually pull that trick. You can't actually recompile them and relink it. Again, editing binaries is sort of out. In this Gumba, and if necessary, that's a final resort, and then one of the hackers in our firm actually has a script called, basically, based on LPAC that will change the R path and the list of libraries that applications linked against, but otherwise change nothing. But again, it's a little fragile, and you don't want to be in the business of doing that. So what we do instead is we... If we have to, we do it, but what we'd rather do is just grab the application. So we have a little Perl script that will take an existing vendor application and grab it into a shell script. We rename the vendor app within a hidden directory, create a shell script that has the name of the original application, there's an LD library path instead of LD preloads, and then it invokes the original application that we've carefully shuffled off to the side. And that sort of works most of the time, and it works well enough that we can work through this. It's not quite enough. IBM actually expects that some parts of their vendor product, somewhere in the deep prefix, is able to write data. And obviously, if you have a read-only network file system, that's not going to work. So, somewhere in the AFS tree, we have symlink into /var/temp something, and we have a special boot script that goes in each and every host to make sure those directories exist and are world writable and that the files are created with the appropriate permissions. Do you see how painful it is? This is just a DB2 client, and we have to do global boot scripts. Now, to make things worse, and anyone who works on open source software, please take this as a valuable lesson. DB2 has a so-called database directory, which is a list of databases, and what their name is, basically what their name is, what their host name is, what their port number is, and basically how to research. Okay? Now, we want that file to be globally the same everywhere, because we want applications to be able to run everywhere. So every application should be able to talk to every database, no matter where it's run. If we can't have this machine knowing 3 databases, and this other machine knowing 5 databases, and this other machine knowing 6 databases. Also, since databases may move from one physical machine to another physical machine over time, we don't want to have to touch 10,000 plus servers to tell them where their trace is. But the IBM, in all their wisdom, decided that the database directory is a binary undocumented format file that depends on the platform and the DB2 release. Okay? Ooh, helpful. So, the way we traditionally did this is that we had a whole bunch of sacrificial machine for the cross-protocol platform support and DB2 release support, where we would run a bunch of DB2 system commands to create that file, then copy that file, and make a global copy available on a network file system. Which is a pain and slow, and it means that you have to keep, like, for every platform that anyone has ever run, you have to keep a special machine around that you can build this stuff on. So, what we ended up doing is we reverse engineered the binary format on each end of the control, so we have one script and one machine that knows how to go against that cross-border of releases and platforms and build this. But again, who wants to be in the business of reverse engineering vendor binary files? So what you want to do as an open source application owner is make sure that A, the location of your configuration file is configurable, so that if you have 2 or 3 releases with incompatible files, you can have them side by side, and B, that the file is text and it's documented what's in there and what it means. In an ideal world, you can allow people to put in their own comments and RCS IDs. Now, what I described is basically 99% of all open source applications. Yeah? Vendor has done to this. Yes? This is also security. I'm generating the same file everywhere. What we do is we have Kerberos handshakes between clients and servers. So the fact that you know where the database lives doesn't mean that you can connect to the database or select data from the database. Does that answer your question, Susan? Okay, let's take that offline. So the cost of just taking the DB2 client is several man-months for several skilled engineers, and all of our developers have to know how to link against all these libraries. And we have to patch every vendor product using DB2 in a quite exhaustive and painful manner. And that's just one application from one vendor. Okay? We have hundreds of vendor applications from dozens of vendors, who all do things in their own marvelous, incompatible, crappy, binary ways. Okay? People doing horrible stuff like Java versions will be installed here that will check your system for patches, trying to apply patches to your running kernel before they want to install a binary. Yeah, so we end up reverse engineering the encrypted compressed archive that the installer uses so you can extract the bloody binaries. And this is not the business you want to be in. So, and this is, I was really ashamed when I came in here and had to wait for a start presentation. Someone was doing all these beautiful things with movies and pictures and layouts. And this is the most fancy thing I did. I have 3 calls in one slide. So, the cost of making changes to an environment at the infrastructure level as opposed to an application level depends on how big the change is. So, OS release is 100% compatible, trivial. As soon as you go to not quite compatible OS releases or not quite compatible hardware platforms, or it gets more expensive, if you move to non-compatible hardware platforms or completely new operating systems, it gets very expensive indeed. So, if you have a new release that's completely compatible, an example of this would be going from Solaris 7 to Solaris 8, and really all you have to do is some of our Unix engineers install the new OS and put it into the Android file system. We make some changes to our make environments, and we make some changes to our client configuration to allow people to compile for the new platforms and start using new platform-specific features. And we may, in some cases, rebuild some of the infrastructure libraries to use those new features, but we don't have to. So that's relatively cheap. Several man-months work, but that's relatively cheap. The next step is the new release is not 100% compatible. 2 examples, when we went from Red Hat Enterprise Linux 2 to 3, some idiot decided to change the size of the pthread condition variable from 12 bytes to 32 bytes, and as a result broke binary compatibility for each structure in C++ class that contained the pthread conf. And if you run applications that will mixture, say, a library compiled on one version and a binary compiled on the other version, things broke at runtime. Yeah. Another example of stuff that broke, Solaris 8 to 9, soon changed the way that the dynamic linker worked. And they know if you do an LD preload and your library contains an ARPA, one of the two wins. And previously, LD preload wins, Solaris 9, ARPA wins. So, if you hack an application to work with LD preload, it no longer works in Solaris 9. If we have to redo our integration efforts for vendor applications, very painful. Yes? Just do a list of issues. You'll find this out by experience, and in some cases, very painful experience. So,
they don't give me a list, but they give them a lot more money.
Yeah, well. So, to give you an example, from both from Red Hat 2 to 3, we had pushed out Red Hat 3. Application teams were starting to run this. They were getting random crashes. We talked to Red Hat. They had no idea what's going on. We debugged the issue with GDB and reported to Red Hat and said, oh yeah, now that you mentioned it, that was an incompatible change. No, we're not going to fix it. Good luck. But we recommend that you recompile all your in-house applications. And that support libraries. Oh, and whatever vendor product they depend on. So, you can see here, the cost of going to a not quite compatible operating system release is quite high. Similarly, suppose that you have a new hardware platform that is almost, it may be not quite 100% backwards compatible. And a good example would be to go from the 32-bit Intel to the 64-bit Intel, EM64T or AMD64 platforms, and run all the existing binaries unchanged without emulation. There's no need to change existing applications. We have to allow compilation for new platforms. We have to set up some new make rules and new accessory for AFS. And there's some pain in allowing 32-bit and 64-bit versions of the same application to run at the same time. So you have to decide if you have something called slash lib, so that contains the 32-bit libraries, so that contains the 64-bit libraries, so that contains both, how are you ever going to change this? So there's some pain involved, but again, it's not insane. If you have a new platform, the cost goes up immensely. We tried Itanium, the non-compatible Intel stuff, which can run the 32-bit Intel under emulation, but not quite perfectly and rather slow. No, we're going to assume that we stick with the same operating system, and the operating system is source code compatible. So the case of Titanium isn't actually true, because the memory barriers and the memory model change in fundamental ways. We assume that they were compatible. Then, in order to even get up and running, you have to get AFS and Kerberos and the various volume manager and everything that you need to even get a booting unit system. You have to get it up and running. That takes several months. And then, each of your infrastructure components, you have to completely rebuild it. In the case of Perl, we have to rebuild Perl 5.6 and Perl 5.8. So it's about 200 modules, each of which is available in several releases. So we had one guy who did nothing for 6 months but rebuilding Perl and Perl modules for a new platform. Multiply that by the number of infrastructure components that you need. Can I mention PHP, Python, Apache, vendor applications? It is really expensive. We basically had our entire Unix engineering team, about 25 people, including the core infrastructure guys, doing nothing else for 6 to 8 months, except build support for a new platform. Question?
AMD.
So as I said, the previous one, AMD is obviously the much better choice. But it wasn't available and sanctioned at the time that Titanium came out. Now, something similar is the cost for a completely new operating system. So, when you start effectively from scratch with a new operating system on either the same hardware platform or new hardware platform, you don't just have to recompile your application, you have to re-port your applications. Okay? No, even within the Unix system, things are never 100% compatible at compile time, and even when they are, the compatible calls generally aren't optimal. If you switch from one Unix to another Unix, and you just do a plain vanilla recompile, say from 8BUX to Solaris, things will work, will be far from optimal. So you spend a lot of time changing the code of the application switch. Thread libraries, thread models, memory allocation libraries, networking calls, etc. So the model estimate is that it's 20 plus man years, 12 plus months of elapsed time to bring in a completely new platform, whether it's the same existing hardware platform or not. Now the fee that is obviously must be enormous. Let's take my own case. I get paid a shitload of money. 20 times that is a lot of money indeed. So it makes sense to try and do something like bringing Windows NT, Windows 2000, Windows XP, whatever, out of the Android file system. But BSD over Linux doesn't make sense for us, certainly not at this time. Because the payback just isn't there. Now, get into more of that a little bit. First, mention some of the things we don't like for new operating systems. Okay? If any operating system depends on automated updates, such as the Ford system, or apt-get, or Red Hat Carpet, or the Zimian auto updates, it basically means that it tries to automatically update something that we don't want to be updated. Okay, we have to turn that off. We have to circumvent that system. You can turn it off, but you no longer get the payback from that system. Any operating system that depends on binary drivers and binary modules is a pain. Especially if that dependency is very, very low in the infrastructure stack. So if you depend on binary drivers for your file system, or binary drivers for a particular hardware card, and that binary driver tries to do some sort of checksum on your operating system image to make sure you're running an approved operating system image without local patches, it becomes very, very painful. You get a supposedly binary compatible upgrade, which you find out after the fact is not. And generally you find out by trading applications, core dumping during trading hours. You don't have it. If you get new hardware without driver support, say IBM ships you a new Blade server that only does serially attached SCSI, to which the first Linux drivers will probably become available in mid-2006. We're not going to deploy thousands of those Blades because we can't even boot them. Any system that comes without remote management or remote debugging is basically useless. If you have 10,000 servers, you don't want to have 500 monkeys who just run around the machine room trying to insert floppies into machines to try and get like a quarter extra image. You want to be able to do that remotely, means remote debugging, remote power management, remote reboots, remote extraction of quarters, and analyze them as sensibly as possible.
Just go back there for 1 second. I mean, the binary driver issue, and I think everybody knows from the discussion that's going on, you know, the BSD suffers the same problems that the Linuxes do. Even with all the influence that the Linuxes have, when it comes to big corporations such as the minor firm that you work for,
Yeah, I mean, we're all in the same boat. I mean, we're all in the same boat with binary drivers.
So, yes, binary drivers are evil, and I don't say that Linux is better than BSD.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
At this point, anyone who depends on binary drivers sucks. So, if you want to build the ideal competitor to Linux, make sure you have no binary drivers, no binary compatibility without announcing them. Okay?
OpenBSD.
That's actually one of the best things that came out of the BSD world in the last year. The fact that Beal is basically demanding open documentation for the drivers means that everybody in open source world can finally start getting rid of this binary driver. Where I get, like, and that means that 5 to 10% of my mysterious operating system kernel crashes go away. That's perfect. We should give that guy as much beer and whiskey as he wants.
Look, if there's an irrelevant 38-year-old developer in Canada somewhere in the woods,
yes.
Imagine your firm turned around and did the same thing. Because it actually goes back to another discussion I had about the vendor and binary issue. It's that if the larger corporations, especially finance companies in Manhattan, turned around to the vendors and said, hey, you know what? We're tired of dealing with binary issues. We're having all these compatibility problems. We don't want core dumps anymore because it's something completely irrelevant to our application, blah, blah, blah. And so actually, I mean, great what Theo's doing, but Theo's more like the mouse that roared.
Yeah, well, so...
Not the person.
Look, so, yeah, do you think we don't mention this to our vendors?
But you still buy this stuff?
Well, yeah, that's so there's like, so you know, so
short them. If you guys shorted Intel,
let's just say we try and put as much pressure on them as we can. And to give an example, in case of the DB2 client, the next major release will behave like it's a open source bridge. You can install as many versions side by side as you want, in as many directories as you want. You give it the base directory, and we'll use a facility link that we call Thor Origin, which was invented in Solaris 3.5 days. And IBM, after only 12 years of that stuff existing, finally start working with it. So, yes, putting pressure on vendors has an effect, but even if you put insane amounts of pressure on a vendor like IBM, and even if they, right at the moment, if you say it, they say, yes, you're right, we're going to put it on the next release, the fix is still 24 months away. Okay, that's the nice thing about open source. You can fix it yourself, and it works right away. In an ideal world, we would not depend on any commercial vendor products at the infrastructure level below applications. Do I scream at my management for buying stuff from vendors that, yes, I do scream at my management, and they tell me it's a business choice?
Question here about the lack of management. What do you need in all of those things? I mean, do you have a list of requirements that you need for remote management?
It's a good question. Do I have a list of requirements for remote management? I don't, but my Linux engineering folks always do. Okay, and yes, if you're interested, we can get you that list.
Tristan!
Oh, okay. Especially because of those firewalls.
Yeah, well, good answer. Like, FreeBSD allows you to do remote management with FireWire, but let's be fair, okay? FireWire extends how far? 2 yards at most? So if I have a machine that breaks in Tokyo, I want to be able to get it crashed on my desk in Manhattan. And I want to be able to analyze that crash code or actually file it away, and if the same type of crash code occurs 40 times, then I want to start to analyze it. Okay, so FireWire is not even assumed to actually allow people in your machine world. Given the amount of accidents that electricians have caused over time, we don't allow people in the machine rooms during trading hours.
It's
even with KVM switches, it's not good. Okay, so ideally, you want to be able to, at a machine, when a machine crashes, have some sort of remote hardware management filter that you can remotely tell, dump your entire memory image on this separate hard disk, and we will analyze it later. Linux doesn't have a great solution to Solaris. It actually has a better solution than anyone else, but basically if you buy a Solaris V40 server, it comes with an embedded Linux machine that allows you to do remote power management so that if Solaris crashes, this Linux will kick in the pans and tell it to reset. So,
But frankly, it seems to me that your firm, mysterious firm, somehow is in a position where they're paying $5 and getting a $6 solution, though, with Linux, when they could be paying $5 with...
Okay? So, when would you change course? Okay, when would you say we're going to throw out Linux and put in BSD? Okay? and you only tend to be in certain specific cases. Like obviously, if your old hardware OS is getting discontinued, you get rid of it. Okay? If the old hardware OS is no longer competitive, you get rid of it. So that led to our great migration from Solaris Spark to Linux on Intel, because basically for a machine in 10th of the priority was 5 times the performance. That's even Wall Street can see that. But beyond that, if you stick with the same hardware, the new hardware operating system has to have a much better price performance for key new features if you want to earn back your migration costs. So there's a very big difference between BSD coming in a site that has no Linux and no PC hardware, and a site that already has Linux and is fairly happy to slightly unhappy. And there's just a payback has to be there. So if you look at what we currently do, we have Intel compatible chips, the 32 and the AMD / EM64, basically the new 64-bit multi-titanium. We have Linux and Windows, generally 2 and 4 CPU systems, no big SMP with some exceptions. And we have a lot of old Solaris Spark that ideally we'd like to get rid of, but can't quite yet. So, if you look at the alternative hardware you've tried, Titanium Lab is underwhelmed. OPC is not really price competitive, and really the only two vendors are Apple and IBM. Apple is not really a serious player yet, and IBM, like we buy hardware and we buy mainframes from them, and that doesn't leave us very happy. So, what other CPUs are there? The AlphaChip is dead. The only really other competitive is the low power, low voltage, medium performance ARM chips, and they're just not suitable for large compute farms. So really storage yet is Intel compatible or nothing. So alternative OSs, if they're not 100% compatible, which nothing is, okay? Like they have to be 100% compatible, or they need to have support for every vendor application that we need, and they need to fit in, either fit into or made to fit into our AFS mode where we keep nothing on a local machine. And it has to be provably better than what we have now, because otherwise the migration costs in time and money, but also opportunity costs where our engineers are not doing something else, we have to earn that money back. So obviously we looked at macOS X server, like limited vendor support, there's one server, there's a very small number of models available, and the multi-threading performance is, well, let's say not great, that's very generous. Yeah. Multi-threading at the Apple OS 10 level is just not great. So we look, obviously, we look at the BSDs all the time. There's a reason I'm here tonight. I think...
Why did you come anyway? You asked them.
So, the BSDs, both free and open BSD, are very competitive with Linux. There are some issues that probably can be overcome with vendor software and with hardware drivers. But it's not really that much better, in the sense that the mere cost of switching for install base requires something systematically 20% or so better in terms of price performance, and it's guaranteed to remain so for several years, because otherwise just 3 months of new hardware improvements will catch up. And since you're going to spend 3 to 6 months integrating the software, you know, you lose your advantage. So, and if I look at some of the key advantages of the BSD system, the port system in BSD is fantastic. If I look, if I compare it to dependencies and RPMs, okay, I don't need to explain it to this crowd. Let's just say that I'd rather update my system in ports if I wanted to have an auto-update system that does updates in place. But it directly conflicts with the model we have, where we keep all these applications side by side. So all we're going to have to do is to either adapt, or more likely, completely redo the port space system to say, okay, if these are your dependencies, I'm going to take all your dependencies and build them side by side with the existing versions of those dependencies in order to completely build a new release or application. And the reason you have to adapt it is that you don't want to do that every night for every OS, for every piece of software that's out there. You don't want to do that when there's a key new feature. So the port system, while it's fundamentally great for small shops that want auto update, doesn't fit what we do. Now, a similar issue goes with security. Like, we have a very large network, but most of it is inside a set of firewalls. Very few people have rules, and even if you do have rules, you can't get much done because we have Kerberos to protect every machine, both for logins, for database handshakes, pretty much around everything. It's not to say we have no security holes, but it's more like where the same user being password is used for all trading applications, where, you know, frankly, the OS security no longer makes a difference. So security is mostly an issue for deployment-facing plans. And when people develop applications, they really want to make sure that the application runs the same in the deployment-facing plan that it runs in-house. So you don't want to have two different platforms. The in-house platform, for better or worse, is going to be the client-facing platform. Okay? Just mind you, the client-facing plan runs a copy or a selection of the AFS tree. They don't really run our internal environment, but it looks the same from somebody deploying software. So while everybody knows FreeBSD and OpenBSD is much better in terms of security than your standard Linux installation, since we don't want to run it inside, yet it's not a sufficient selling point to switch our internal 10,000 servers just so that our 500 web servers are going to have less problems then. Also, releases. I mean, one of the key things about the BSDs is that they have predictable and frequent releases of high quality. It compared to Linux, where we have more frequent releases of very unpredictable quality, and every 2 or 3 years there's actually a release that really works. But we're a big corporation, we're boring. We want to do one upgrade every 2 or 3 years, and we want to have a vendor that sticks with that. So from our viewpoint, something like Red Hat Enterprise Linux, or even Microsoft, where the same desktop with only the most minor changes is going to be run and supported for 5 years, if only because even if they wanted to, they couldn't do a new release. That works for us. And we want to be able to move to a new release without upgrading the old one in place. Okay, we want to basically create a new host, so new software variable. We sometimes do software upgrade in place, but we basically do a one-to-one switch, so we don't upgrade components, we basically reinstall the entire OS image on the machine. And given that the applications aren't stored on the machine, that's actually very, very fast. Somebody shifts a software model for the OS, saying, okay, I'm going from Solaris 8, internal patch 5 to internal patch 6. You reboot the host, 20 minutes later, it's running the new OS image and everything just works. And also something very important that seems to be missing from some of the open source OS projects. Support for really old, ancient, crappy stuff. We still run Solaris 2.5. Yeah? Not on thousands of machines, but on dozens of machines. We run Solaris 2.7, we run Solaris 2.8, we run Solaris 2.9, and we're looking at running Solaris 2.10. We run Red Hat Enterprise version 2, version 3, version 4. So, the tendency I tend to see in some of the BSDs is that they come up with a new release every 6 months. And it's a high quality release, it's an exciting release. But they don't support 4 releases back. So if I want to stick with an image for 3 to 5 years, I can't always get that support.
You guys hired a couple developers.
Sure, if we hired a bunch of developers, you could do that. So that's the trade-off we would have to do. Okay? Now, if I go to my management and say, we can either pay this vendor $1 million, and they're going to guarantee to support us for 3 years, even though the support is known to be crap. Okay? Or I go to this place on the web, right? Download FreeBSD, and they don't pay anything. We're going to have to hire our in-house people, which go from a different part of the balance sheet. They will show up in your budget as opposed to the finance department. And he's going to say no. So, that's a fact of life. So yes, the hiring developers to support infrastructure as opposed to paying a larger sum of money to a vendor that does a crappy job with the same thing.
Who you could sue.
Who you could hypothetically sue. Management would rather pay the money. So, also, and this is just unfair, it's a timing issue. Linux had an easier time pulling in, because all it had to do was be better than Solaris Spark. Okay, when we brought it in, we didn't care that much about vendor support, because all we were going to run initially was the compute-based applications that we wrote in-house for, say, the big fixed-income calculation plans. And as that proved itself, we then started rolling out ever more widely. Now, FreeBSD and OpenBSD and NetBSD are not going to be significantly faster than Linux on the same hardware for a compute-based application. But that's just not going to happen. I mean, even if the OS itself was 100 times faster, that would shave 1% of the total, at most, of one of the total applications. So, even though Linux may not be as good, it sets the bar for BSD in terms of required vendor and product support. And BSD is going to have to be at least 20 to 30% better in order for us to be willing to make that move. So I just don't think that's going to happen. So what would it take? Well, clearly better performance that is probably better for several years in the future. With similar AFS and software support. Or a bunch of unique features that can't just be cloned on Linux. killer applications, killer file system, killer closure software, superb virtualization that we can somehow see that Linux will never get. Okay? And that's hard, because if the BSD is coming with something really great, and it's really smart, then the Linux will flip the source code and you're going to have a re-implementation that is equivalent to the first order of approximation from the outside view within 3 months. It's just a fact of life. And in fact, they may even GPO whatever improvement they come up with, and then the BSD is going to take it back. So the key things that we are looking at that we're not happy with is virtualization, and it's confusing that there's several Zens, but this is the Zen with an X. The ability to still basically run many virtual machines on the same host, and the ability to also take one of those running virtual machines and move it to different physical hardware without interrupting operations. What you can do with a virtual machine in Zen is you can have a database server running, you can clone it to new hardware, and then with an interruption of maybe a tenth of a second of the thing being done, you can move that running process elsewhere without interrupting even TCP/IP connections coming in from a client. That's really insanely great. And with the faster CPUs coming out, where we say 4 CPU blocks with multi-core AMD CPUs can have 8 or 16 real CPUs, is really important for us. I/O scheduler, something that Linux absolutely sucks at, is the ability to give applications or virtual machines guaranteed I/O bandwidth. Maker does this very well, and we really need the equivalent of a nice level for I/O. And as we all know, NICE is not perfect in the sense that it's not instantaneous, it is not super accurate, and we don't need that. We need to be able to say, of these three virtual machines, this one should get approximately 80% of the I/O bandwidth whenever it wants, even though the underlying disk resources and network resources are shared across all virtual machines. Stability on the network pressure. This is something the BSDs have always done better than this. It's sort of insane that we have to allocate like 8 gigabytes of extra swap space just to cater for the memory leaks in the OS and the applications. We want to be able to do crash debugging. If a system crashes, not about application crashes, if a system crashes, I want to be able to do postmortems without having to go to the physical machine and without having to book that physical hardware. I want to take the relevant information, move it aside, and analyze it on a similar machine of the same hardware type at my own leisure at a later time. When my key trading system crashes, I don't want to have to run the trading system elsewhere. I want to take the memory issue memory image and analyze it overnight elsewhere, and then just restart my application. And power management is also very important. We are constrained for electricity usage and air conditioning in our machine rooms. So any operating system that can actually reduce power usage when the machines are not used at top speed will earn its money back in the sense that we can increase density and reduce power usage. And that sounds like a marginal saving until you realize that a new machine room is like tens of millions of dollars. And if we can do with 5 machine rooms instead of 6 or 8 instead of 10, that's a major saving. So these are the things we're looking for. BSD can consistently do these better than Linux. We are getting very, very tempted to change. There are also hypothetical, or not so hypothetical, stumbles that Linux could make that would cause us to seriously look for alternatives. So suppose that there was a successful legal attack. We're not talking about people like Skull doing scaremongering, a successful legal attack that somehow doesn't touch the BSDs. Now, what I'm most afraid for as a free software guy is patent lawsuits, and I see very few chances of a patent lawsuit succeeding against Linux and completely not touching the BSDs. I just don't see it happening.
Oh.
Yeah, so is this.
With the BSDs, you don't have to worry about RMS, too.
Which is the next issue. So, if for whatever reason, kernel development comes to a halt, okay, now we've seen this in BSD all the time, then what do we have forks? If somebody doesn't get along with Theo, he gets moved elsewhere. Linux is well known for its freedom flame wars, but at some point these could actually bring the whole system to a halt. If you have still need 500 Linux forks, then frankly the whole thing is going to just still want to grind to a halt.
But what do you mean? It's like the economy goes like this, Linux distros go like that.
Yeah, it is. Well, from our viewpoint, we don't care as much about the distros as we think of one distro working.
Okay.
Yeah. So this is a hypothetical stumble where BSD has its act better together than Linux. Suppose that there's new hardware that comes out that we really, really like, the key features, and for some reason BSD moves to exploit it, and the key distributions for Linux don't. Then again, we are going to take a look at switching. If there are consistent major bugs in vendor release, especially if Red Hat continues to screw up the way they do, we're going to look at alternatives. And the way we set up things is as expensive to switch to SUSE as it is to switch to FreeBSD. So again, that will be a key issue for us. Or if, you know, software and hardware vendors systematically abandon the shield, people give up on it, which, again, I don't see happening, but is the kind of thing that could occur that would cause us to switch. But short of these kind of stumbles, or the ones I showed in the previous slide where BSD gains a unique advantage over Linux, it's not worth it for us at this time to switch. Now, I think that story is probably going to be different if a site hasn't chosen Linux yet. Now, to some extent, such sites are going to go by what everybody else does, because Wall Street very much has a herd mentality. If two or three of the big names pick an operating system, everybody else is going to do it because, frankly, then they don't commit to choice themselves. But if you're coming from an AIX or an HPUX world and you're switching to some sort of Unix on Intel, okay, now, you're probably not going to go for Solaris on Intel, and you're probably not going to go for Scala. So the real choices are Linux or BSD. And BSD is very competitive, and if the key vendor support is there for you, from software vendors, so IBM or Oracle or Veritas or whatever your dependencies are, and then that's very important. If you can get hardware support from the vendor, like we buy a lot from Dell and HP and IBM, and they assist us with hardware debugging if there is some sort of incompatibility between the operating system and the hardware. You can't have a situation where the operating system folks say, well, the vendor doesn't talk to us, we have no idea how to fix this. If that occurs, then that OS is certainly no longer relevant. And to give an example of this, we had a new IBM Blade server, 64-bit AMD CPUs, and we're getting mysterious reboots. And it was funny enough, like several weeks of very intensive work with the hardware vendor and the operating system vendor, we tracked it down to like slightly overcritical CPU checks on minor hardware faults, where they treated like your DMA is slightly overloaded error as you must reboot now. If it takes a vendor like IBM combined with Red Hat several weeks to track that down under low pressure, then frankly, I don't see the current BSD model where we're hoping for handouts for vendors in terms of machine specifications working better. Okay? And that's key. We need to get that kind of support for BSD. And something I know that George and team in general are working on, for firms that are only now moving to some sort of Unix on Intel, okay, these firms are not technology leaders, because otherwise they would have been running this for 10 years. So they need to have some sort of guarantee that there is a pool of people available that can work on this. Now, software developers can generally work on anything, but admins are hard to get by. And that's where certification becomes important. And it's really funny because technology gives two firms tend to lie about certifications. Like, if I get a resume for somebody who's proudly listed as Microsoft certification, the resume goes in big. But if you're a new firm, a firm that's new to some sort of Unix on Intel, and you don't really know what platform to pick, when you walk into Barnes & Noble, you see 500 books on Linux and one book on FreeBSD. And frankly, that's going to make a difference. So we really must...
They have man pages.
So, yes.
We only need one book.
We only need one book, I know. Where, an example I gave to George last week in with Red Hat units is to the point that they switched to UTF-8, their default language, but some of their man pages contain incompatible characters. So some of the man pages don't even work. Even if they're like, never mind that their content isn't great, they can't even get it displayed in the first place.
You really need a Linux certification, right?
Yeah.
That's
so, well, right, that's an improvement now, but there's a good point dispute. But so for firms that are only now switching, certification is actually a big one. I think that what the BSDs are doing right now is a very important one. It's a good question. Do we like people that have Red Hat certification? Well, again, in our firm, A, we are very, very different from your vanilla Red Hat and B, we are sufficiently technologically aware that we know certification by itself doesn't mean anything. So I think we generally look for people that have A, proven experience across multiple versions of Unix, because that shows something about their ability to move on with the times, and we look for some sort of a mental ability to learn. It's really for people.
You don't have to, in fact, whatever metric you use to hire them, after they're hired, you see people with Red Hat having any more and less knowledge than people without Red Hat?
Good question. After the fact, after you hire them, do you see Red Hat certification making a difference? I'm not in an area, I can't really tell. I know that of our Unix operations folks, some people that are really good have certification, and some people that are really crappy have certification, and vice versa. So I don't think it's a good prediction.
That's a good answer.
Yeah. But again, if you're new to this, if I didn't know Red Hat at all, and I had no idea what I was getting into, I would want to hire somebody with certification. Okay. In terms of Microsoft, it means that you hire somebody with proven ability to click on dialog boxes. That's all that you want at that point. Yeah, but that's all you need. Okay, that's the end of my talk. I'm sure there will be more questions and more heckling.
There's a sign-up sheet going around, as I mentioned earlier, that ICAS, the distribution of a PDF for this nice PSP con September 17th. So sign up and talk to Ike. This will be going around. I expected to see you.
Okay, well, I know somebody had very specific questions about MQ and security, and I'll take it the whole problem once my Microsoft just left my head. Okay? Any other questions? Then it's back to George. I'm sure it's more fun.